Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Jenna Flanagan, filling in for Allison Stewart today. Our next guest has had a superlative career. Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick earned his medical degree at the age of 22. He took his experience into the field of medicine out into the world, lecturing across the country about unconscious bias in academic medicine. He is a fierce advocate for those diagnosed with sickle cell anemia, a disease he lives with. And he does it all while serving as the current president of Howard University, one of the nation's top historic black universities. But HBCUs have been struggling to stay afloat in the past few years. And though Howard has one of the most endowments of that group, maintaining institutions to encourage the higher education of black Americans is something that Dr. Frederick passionately advocates for around the country. And here now to discuss his wide-ranging career and the future of HBCUs is Dr. Wayne Frederick. Doctor, welcome to All of It.
Thanks for having me.
So, I feel like this is kind of a silly question considering we're both African-American, but what drove you to start addressing unconscious bias in the medical field?
Well, one of the major concerns that I started seeing was less and less representation, especially in certain types of specialties. I'm a surgical oncologist myself. I trained at MD Anderson Cancer Center. I was the fourth or fifth black to train there in surgical oncology. And this was in between 1999 and 2003. And I thought to myself, this is really concerning. I took my first faculty position at the University of Connecticut, where once again I was the only person of color in the department initially, and then there was a neurosurgeon as well who was originally from Nigeria. And so as I looked around, you know, the student body and then the trainees that we had in the pipeline, again, very significant underrepresentation. And on returning to Howard, I recognized that Howard was playing a significant role in terms of the number of persons we were putting in some of these specialties. And I really started to look into who really rises all the way in the hierarchy, who gets into the different specialties. And as I looked at that data, I was alarmed at what that data was suggesting. It was suggesting that less and less was happening. And sure enough, a few years later, after I first started talking about this issue, there's data to show actually hard facts that we have a problem. So in 1978, we had more African-American males apply to and enroll in our medical schools in this country than in 2014. And so you think of what has happened in that, you know, 40-year period in this country, to have that number going down is alarming. So we do have a crisis. And then it also spills over into health, what type of health you provide, because now you have physicians, we're talking about whether or not physicians are culturally competent. And it is true. And I think certain parts of the population are going to suffer more if we don't have more physicians that represent them.
I'm wondering if you can unpack the notion of culturally competent physicians just a little bit. So give people an example of what that means.
Yeah, so I'll give you a personal example. I have sickle cell anemia. It primarily affects African Americans. It's associated with significant pain crises. I've broken an arm and a leg, and the pain that I have when I have a sickle cell crisis is nowhere close to what I experienced when I broke my limbs, as an example. So to have that type of pain, that's where you don't have a deformity someone can see, is very hard for a physician to get that. If it's a physician who has never seen a patient with sickle cell before, doesn't have a family member, doesn't know about it because that's not their background experience, or they attended a medical school where the hospital doesn't have a certain type of population, and so they didn't see those patients, they automatically assume that, you know, that person may not be really in that much pain. They don't manage their pain well. They treat them as if they're drug seeking. All of those are examples. Another example is I'm a type 1 diabetic. I started taking insulin in 2005. The price of insulin over the time that I've been taking it has quadrupled. So again, if you're not a culturally competent physician, you're speaking to someone low income, whether they're white or black, but you can't relate to the circumstance that they're in. Just writing a prescription and walking away is not a solution. You know, you've got to put things in context. What type of job do they have? What type of insurance do they have? Do they have access to go get this med? And how does that impact them? So there's several ways in which that lack of cultural competency in terms of understanding a patient's circumstance and then soothing and then tailoring their prescription and their treatment to their circumstance is important.
Well, you brought up two very specific examples. However, we've also seen studies dealing with perhaps maternal health or something. And even when things like education and income are included or controlled for, we still see disparities in healthcare outcomes. So, again, why are we seeing that?
Yeah, and that's because, again, we bring our lives into our practices. And that's something that our medical schools don't teach us about how we manage that, right? There's not a medical school curriculum that effectively, I think, addresses this, to be quite frank with you. And so I give you, I think the best study that I've seen on this was published in one of the journals, the Journal of American Medical Association. Incoming medical students in the first year at Hopkins were given a survey to look for unconscious bias, implicit and explicit. And I'll give you one example of the question was they showed a black male lawyer, a white female toll booth operator. And the question was, which one of these people would be able to A, understand and inform consent for surgery better, and B, you would basically trust that they understood what the risks were. And the majority of those incoming students, and you have to remember, I think at least when you're entering medical school, that's probably your highest level of altruism you'll ever attain, right? Every incoming medical student wants to save the world. And a vast majority, and the majority of the students actually said the white female toll booth operator would be better equipped to understand informed consent as opposed to the black lawyer. And so we bring that with us. Now, what that study elegantly was able to show is that if we do appoint this out to students throughout the course of their education, we can influence them so that they don't make decisions that affect how they practice. They don't let that unconscious bias start weaving in to how they practice. But if you don't do anything to undo and unwrap what they're bringing to the table, it means that it will impact what they do. And so it starts very early on because of the society that we're in. And so we have to look at the fact that our society is full of those unconscious biases. And in every field that we can imagine, we take that into those fields.
Is there really a way, though, to address this? Like, I mean, you were just saying that this is a societal thing that we're dealing with. So is it possible to, I guess, retrain people or to get them to recognize their unconscious bias in such a specific place, just in your medical studies, just in your medical work? Meanwhile, it might continue to go on unchecked in every other aspect of your life.
Yeah, and I think it's impossible to do that. I think that even when we do it in medicine, we have to do it in a way that it impacts everything that you do. And I want to be clear about this. We all suffer from this, right? So the same talk that I've given all around the country, when I first prepared it, my last slide was a picture of my kids. Mm-hmm. My son was dressed in full surgical garb with a surgical hat on, and my daughter was dressed in a sweater that said Howard. And they were little kids at the time, and my wife, who has a degree in computer science and would help me with my PowerPoint presentations, came in the room and said, "You're going to give a talk on unconscious bias in academia, and your son is dressed as a surgeon, and your daughter looks like a cheerleader." So that's now my penultimate slide, and my last slide is both of them dressed as surgeons to make the point that in some way, shape, or form, it may reside in all of us. And sometimes it's not with malintent, but it may be because of socialization. And the same thing at Howard. When I started, we had one permanent female dean out of 13, right? Howard's DNA is social justice. Why our undergrad population was majority female. Mm-hmm. So I went about the process of saying we got the answer to this. So we have search committees now that have addressed that cultural competency and the unconscious bias. So now we have 10 out of 13 deans as a result who are women.
I do want to talk a little bit about your advocacy for sickle cell anemia. I feel like you sort of addressed why it might not be getting the same kind of attention as other diseases. You mentioned it affects primarily African Americans or people of African descent. But first of all, for people who aren't familiar with sickle cell, what is it?
So sickle cell is a hemoglobinopathy, which is a fancy word for saying that the hemoglobin in patients with sickle cell is deformed. There's a genetic alteration of just one single point where one single amino acid is different. In that gene, and as a result, the hemoglobin does not carry oxygen as well. And when it does lose the oxygen molecule, it gets twisted in a way that it can cause the cells to become more straight and very hard to pass through the blood vessels. The cells end up being shaped as a sickle instead of being round and pliable. And as a result of that congestion at your joints in particular, where your blood vessels may narrow, you can get severe pain crises, inflammation. But you have kids with sickle cell who get strokes, who get kidney disease. The mortality is significant, for especially if you don't have significant ways to get treated, to stay hydrated, to control the pain, to avoid strokes and those types of diseases. So it's a big issue. And so one of the things I thought I needed to do was to just raise awareness. As a surgeon, I don't know any other surgeons who have sickle cell. I felt it was important to raise the awareness that this disease does affect, regardless of the disease, my ability to attain a certain modicum of success through academics was really because of the support. Howard had a sickle cell center. There were strong advocates for me to be well, healthy, both in and out of the classroom, and that, I think that plays a big difference. And so, yes, I feel very strongly that there's so much more we could do to raise awareness and to bring about a cure for this disease.
And speaking of bringing about a cure, is that it's just more research that's needed? Is it more, what is it that is needed to address this?
Yeah, there's more research that's needed. I mean, recently there have been very major news headlines about the fact that getting stem cell transplants is providing a cure for some patients, and that's something that we need to bring more information to our community about. But again, you need to bring more dollars to the disease process and more focus. It's probably the most studied genetic disorder, the most that we know about in the history, but I would say probably the most underfunded when you look at how close we could have been to a cure if we just had more attention placed on it.
All right. Well, speaking of funding dollars, I now want to turn our conversation to HBCUs. Now, I was saying earlier that Howard has one of the most number of endowments of all the HBCUs, but we've seen a lot of the schools struggle. Some of them have come close to closing. Some of them have closed. Why is it so important to keep these schools going? What is the value that they're bringing to our overall American society?
Yeah, the fabric of this American society, I would say in a lot of ways, is underpinned by the black middle class. I mean, if you look at what happened through the 50s, 60s, 70s, the black middle class in a lot of ways really rose up. And I think a lot of the successes of the country in terms of many different fields came from that. And places like Howard University have produced more African-American physicians than any other institution in this country. The sad thing is, that dependence on our HBCUs is becoming more and more in terms of being able to diversify these fields. And if we fund them less, it means that we are going to suffer in terms of that potential outcome. And so that's why I think we should be doing it. It's not an issue of relevance, because as I said earlier, if you have less males applying to medical school now than you did in 1978, this issue that we talk about, access is open and so on, is just not real. It's just, there's systematic issues that prevent these students from getting from point A to point B.
Well, as president of the university, what is it that you feel is the most necessary? Because, of course, we've heard some presidential candidates. Elizabeth Warren has talked about getting billions of federal dollars. So has Kamala Harris, who is a graduate of HBCU herself. What is it that you think is desperately needed the most?
So I do think funding is needed, but I do think we need to recognize that funding does not have to be something unusual. Every year we have Pell Grant money that is unspent. And I think if you use some of that unspent money to build infrastructure at these schools, it would help. So I do think support, and especially alumni support, is critical.
All right. Well, Dr. Wayne Frederick, I want to thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we'll be right back.